Welcome to Catalyst Convos, empowering stories and expert insights, because every story matters and every voice deserves to be heard.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Catalyst Convos. I'm Amy Grover, Executive Director of Patient Advocacy at Catalyst Pharmaceuticals, and we're glad you're here today, because we're exploring a perspective that we don't often hear about, the experiences of men who are navigating caregiving in rare disease families.
And I'm Carrie Austria, part of the patient advocacy team. We talk a lot about caregivers, but today we want to focus specifically on the unique realities men face in these situations, from traditional expectations about strength and providing to the deeper challenges of vulnerability and support. This is a conversation we really need to have.
We're honored to have two incredible men joining us here today. Mark, whose wife is living with Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, and Bill, a father navigating life with Duchenne muscular dystrophy in his family. Both are here today to share their honesty about the pressures, the unexpected shifts in their family roles, and what they've learned along the way. Mark and Bill, thank you so much for being here today.
It's our honor.
Very excited to have you.
Thanks for having us.
We would love to learn a little bit about yourselves, about your family. So, Bill, if you want to start, you know, just tell us a little bit about your family and what brought you into this rare disease world.
Yes, my son has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and my wife and daughter are carriers, manifesting carriers of muscular dystrophy, which brought me to this conversation today.
Thank you for joining us. Mark, what about you?
My name is Mark. I live in Florida, and I've been married to the same wonderful human for 36 years this year. Is that right? We had three daughters. They're all grown, all married. I have two of the dreamiest grandbabies on the planet that are both six at the same time for 2 months right now. The way I came into the caregiving world is first caring for my mother-in-law 11 years ago, who passed on hospice with cancer. And immediately following that, one of my daughters stopped eating, had anorexia, eating disorder challenges. And I was her caregiver for about 6 years, along with my wife. Immediately following that a journey, then my wife, as Amy said, was diagnosed with LEMS, or Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. And that's been a six-year journey this year. So we don't know it all, but there's been a lot of caregiving going on in our household for the last 12 years, and it's our honor for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark, you have been, and we've known each other for a few years now, and you've been so open and honest about, you know, your journey, your relationships within the family. Can you tell us a little bit about the initial reaction to the diagnosis? I know that a lot of people talk about in rare disease, that mourning period. You know, the life that you had is now gone, and now you're on a new path. Can you tell us a little bit about what those first few weeks and months were like?
Yeah, I sure could. For all three, but I'll focus more on Jamie, since she's a LEMS patient. Definitely shock. I mean, you kind of know something's not right, but then when you find out what it is and the gravity of it, there's some shock, some numbness, I think, especially for us men. We just kind of numb up. We want to compartmentalize. On the other side of the coin, I know, at least with Jamie, there was some relief, because there's this period of not knowing what in the world is wrong. She's hurting. She's in pain. She's not the same person she was, or have the same abilities that she was physically and emotionally. When you find out, then there's some relief. But like you just indicated, then life as you now know it ceased to exist. And as Bill can testify to this, there's not somebody holding your hand saying, here's the next step. I mean, there's clinicians who help, but your family doesn't know what's going on. They don't understand. So yeah, shock, numbness, some relief, and then just trying to stand back and take a breath and say, what's next? Where do I go from here? And that's a journey. It's a never ending journey.
And I kind of feel like, Bill, you had a double punch because you, your son first gets diagnosed and then kind of share about that period with his diagnosis and then finding out about your wife and daughter.
Yes. In fact, I'll take a step back. I was so focused on having kids, the birth, and having healthy kids. And so we thought that we had two healthy kids and really excited about that. I remember back when Marcy told me we were first pregnant, I journaled that day. I feel like my capacity for joy has expanded, which was such a cool thing to feel. And as we went through the birth and having healthy kids and a healthy mom on the other side of it, it was great. And it was when Lucas was five that, and Marcy's background, my wife's background was in physical therapy. And so she had noted some things. And I thought, well, if that's what it is, you know, that's her background. I had a sibling growing up that was handicapped. And, you know, we can champion this, we can help, and we'll get through, but never really dreaming of the severity of what we were facing or what he was facing and therefore we were facing. And so, as Mark mentioned, you just have that numb moment and nothing can prepare you for that. And as we're processing that and even understanding what Duchenne is and how do you get Duchenne, and that's when we found out about the three ways of that. And one is an anomaly in the boy's DNA. So that would be no one else is affected. Or the other way is if a mom has eggs that are affected, but the mom herself is fine. And then it was actually on Marcy's birthday that she received the call for her situation, which is it's in her DNA. And that's something that she needed to then know and look into. And so she now has her cardiologist and dealing with things that we didn't even know what to look, you know, not didn't know to look that direction. And it made some sense looking back in her life. I mean, she ran track, so it wasn't like she wasn't able to, you know, do things physically, but it was always different, and she was affected by that differently. And then, as you mentioned, the third, and that is my daughter. And I remember it was the week of Christmas in 21 that we found that news out. And that is such a compounding thing. And the next phrase I'm going to say here is met with all the respect, and you'll understand, I believe, as I say it. And that is the mom guilt that's felt, even though we, you know, there's nothing that could have been done. It wasn't her family. We weren't looking that way. There was nothing that she obviously had done. So then to have our daughter affected as well, it was hard on top of things there.
Yeah, absolutely. And how, Bill, you know, being a father figure in obviously in your family and, you know, I think Mark kind of alluded to it being the male perspective of wanting to fix things. How did your role in the family or did it change from pre-diagnosis to almost like a triple diagnosis? Did it change throughout this time period?
The very real part of that change was becoming a caregiver. And of course, it's my honor to do so. It's tough at times, but my honor to do so. And that was a shift in role. That's a hard one in the way that you do want to fix it. As guys, we want to be that for our family. And it's really tough when you can't. And the other part is to see your loved ones go through things. You want to be able to help. And that's a hard feeling to feel when you're not able to.
Absolutely. And Mark, you know, you've talked about this before on being there for your wife, who is lovely, and your daughters as well. So how has that changed for you over this progression and journey?
There's so much. And I admire and respect what Bill just shared. And even that last part of wanting to fix it, you could ask Jamie and my daughter how many times I've said, I wish I could take your pain. And in the case of the eating disorder, it was emotional pain. It's not about the food, of course, for my daughter. But for Jamie, sometimes the physical pain, you can't stop it. And you hurt in your soul because you love them so much. The role did change a lot. Frustration of not being able to fix it. And like Bill said, now I'm not just a husband. I don't mean just, but I'm not only a husband or a father. I'm now a caregiver. And it doesn't end. These situations, you don't get better. I grew up in a family that believed in miracles and all those things. That's great. and I respect that. But the prognosis is that as caregivers, we'll be dealing with this the rest of our lives or the lives of our loved one. So it has shifted a lot. I think in my daily life, I was raised as a preacher's kid where you don't rock the boat. You walk in love toward everyone and you treat everyone nice. Well, that's kind of a myth because if you treat everyone nice, you're not going to make it very far. Sometimes you have to speak up. Sometimes you have to stand up. And one of the biggest things I have learned as a caregiver, and there's so much, but with both my daughter and my wife, is it's up to me to stand up and say, no, you're not going to do this to them. Or no, I need a second diagnosis. Or I need different meds. Or I need different care. If I don't do it for them, nobody's going to do it. Even my best friends, even the most well-meaning clinician. So you've heard the term mama bear, and I respect that. I'm married to one, but there's papa bear too. Right, Bill? I'm a nice guy.
You are a very nice guy, and I can imagine Papa Bear coming out.
Even in this, on my job as a chaplain, you don't want to mess with my spouse or my kids or the young men in my mentoring circle or my patients, because I'll probably be in the news if you do.
Can you share one of the instances where you had to be Papa Bear in Jamie's defense, where whether she didn't speak up for herself or she wasn't able to?
So, yes, I can think of a recent situation. I won't be too specific about what happened, but she had a regular treatment for limbs that was weekly. I was able to help and assist with it. And then for whatever reason, in the second month of the year, the insurance company said, we're not covering that anymore. What? You're kidding, because this treatment is life-changing for her. It takes away some pain. It makes her feel normal. And we're used to it. We do it every week, every Monday night. It's a process that lasts 3 hours. It's also a time we bond and connect. We're not covering that anymore. Okay, so going through the process of trying to figure out why. And the biggest challenge where I became Papa Bear just in the last 3 months was me talking to the insurance company saying, we're waiting on the pharmacy. Me calling the pharmacy and them saying, we're waiting on your neurologist to sign whatever, whatever. I get on the phone or online with a neurologist and they say, we're waiting for your insurance company. Around and around and around and around. Well, I tell you what, you can only spin so much before blood comes out of your eyeballs. And Papa Bear, like, we went a 12-week period with no treatment. She said to me one day, I feel like I'm back in 2019. I said, babe, what do you mean? She said, my ability to walk, my ability to do anything around the house, to take care of myself, to eat, to bathe, is like 2019. And I'll tell you what, it hurt my soul, but it also made me angry. So I got back on the phone with all three of those organizations, and I was tough. Not mean, but tough, where I just said, I'm not hanging up until we get a resolution. And I didn't. And then, I don't know if I should say this, but one time I said a couple words that my kids taught me that I didn't know existed.
Sometimes you have to do that.
Well, because they weren't really catching what I was saying. And I'm like, you have a patient here whose life is declining. Eventually, it worked out. But I can't even begin to tell you, and Bill would understand this, the number of weeks that it took for me to solve it, where, and I'm not complaining, like Bill said, it's my honor, but I stayed up all night figuring out what steps can I take as her caregiver. And we got it done, and now we have a different treatment, I won't be specific, that is monthly, and it's good. But I wouldn't say it's as effective as what we had.
And that's unfortunate when you have that, you know, that feeling of, oh, this is the path I want to go down, and trying to unravel it, successful, but not quite successful. But I'm going to pivot a little bit, Mark, because you're talking about being Papa Bear. You're talking about being involved. You just went through a story where you're on the phone for days and weeks. But you've also talked about space and the need to recognize when it's time to give your loved one space. Can you elaborate on that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that would apply to my daughter and Jamie, but I'll focus on Jamie again since we're talking about limbs here in my case. I married someone who's super independent. I admire that still. It's one reason why I chose to marry her. She was athletic, like Bill's wife, right? She was athletic, and she could just whip me on the basketball court or any sport. And being super independent, I think sometimes I would smother her wanting to care so bad. But now I'm better at giving her space, and space matters because that patient, even a teenager like Bill's, boy, girl, man, woman, they need space to think through their own diagnosis. And if we're always in their face trying to fix it, at least my wife went insane almost. Give me space.
Looking at with your different, you know, your family dynamics, how have you played Papa Bear for your family members? And what did that look like? And how did that make you feel having to do that?
Yeah, there's been a few different times and a couple different directions or scenarios. And I can very much appreciate what Mark was saying there. And it's tough when you're having to deal with, well, we affectionately say we see all the ologists. So you have a lot of appointments. And for everyone, there seems to be a follow-up that's needed. And there's a procedure or medication or something. And inevitably, something happens where a ball gets dropped. Even if everything went normal, there's a lot to handle. But when something drops, and if you're not the one on top of it, it really elongates. And getting involved, we've received the similar, at times, pointing of fingers in opposite directions and having to get involved in that and say, okay, we're going to get to the bottom of this and identify what, you know, as far as the finger pointing, where is the root cause and to get help. And so that persistence, and it's just sometimes you don't have the bandwidth for that. And when you're forced into having to do that, it's challenging, it's draining. That's one side of it. The other side for Lucas's case, the physical side, and there have been moments where he had been put in physical danger, not in the way you would think of violence or something like that, but in the way of, because of his condition, him being injured, and then also what can happen as a result of injury. It's something you just don't realize or think of, or at least I didn't know about. There is, for instance, with fractures, can lead. I mean, I grew up, you know, I had my broken bones, but that's one thing. For him, a broken bone can be fatal. And those are hard words to say. And that's an extreme case, but also it happens. And so to be that physical protector, and we had a situation, seems odd to say it this way, but it was at church. And there was a young boys that I'm sure they didn't mean to maybe come across as mean, but they were very physical and it was putting Lucas in danger. And so I had to step up and put a stop to that. And through getting their, you know, parents involved to try to get the help that way. And it doesn't feel great. I mean, one, yes, you'll do anything for your kids. So there's that innate part of you. But no, it's not something you want to have to do. But the reality is you have to do.
Well, can I ask, Bill, how did the parents react when you reached out to them? And did you just to kind of explain, since they're probably naive to what may happen?
Yes. And this one is a really unfortunate situation in the way that we didn't get the help from them as we needed. And I have to be careful when I say that, because they did, by their response with us verbally, you know, were very empathetic and said, you know, they understood. But things continued. So we ended up, our result at that point was removing Lucas.
And how did Lucas react to your involvement in helping him through that situation?
And he was young at the time, but grateful. And he wouldn't have known the ramifications that I was fighting against knowing. But for him, in addition to Duchenne, he also has autism. And so he appreciated from that part of it, not having the aggression towards him. So it's a little harder for him to process that.
He knows Dad has his back.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But now you're going into the crazy teenage years. So trying to balance that kind of that Papa Bear, that watching over him, but also giving him his freedom a little bit. Is that hard to navigate?
Yes, he is full-time in a powered wheelchair. And you realize very quickly, you have to navigate that gently because he is able to go places. I mean, the chair itself is 350 pounds or something like that. So sometimes very tactfully talking through things to not make something worse, a situation worse, but at the same time, navigating.
So how did you both go from surviving these diagnoses and getting involved in speaking out in the LEMS community, in the Duchenne community, in the rare disease community? What made you take that step to be a voice?
I can say it was being inspired by the voices before us and so grateful for those that have been before. And in fact, I can't do justice to what has been before us and so grateful for that, but hopeful to be of some help. And it has been amazing, those that we've connected with as a result. And so grateful for those connections. In fact, yours included, as I sit here having this conversation.
Aw, thanks, Bill.
I know. But honestly, I feel like Amy and I have learned so much from you both since we've known you that it's very much reciprocated how we feel about you guys.
And Bill, we recently got to meet your daughter at an event.
Oh, yeah.
So what was that like, bringing your teenage daughter to an event? And how does she get involved? And what's her kind of thoughts on all of this?
That was a big deal in the way of bringing her to the conference. In the past, it was actually just last year was the first conference that she had been to and had been a part of the sibling program they have called SibTrack. And she really enjoyed connecting with the others there. So they can relate. They get her life and she gets theirs.
She doesn't have to explain anything.
Yeah. And as a teenager, that's such a tough thing to go through at any age, but specifically a teenager. And to have others that get it without having to explain it, that was really wonderful. And then this year would have been the first where she was also in some of the sessions. And so she was learning some things and seeing some things. And a few different times she looked over at me. One would have been in, you know, kind of taking in some new information. The other was a very empathetic nod, like, I see, you know, what they're saying because I see it in Lucas kind of thing. And so just her as a sibling and seeing that, as well as I mentioned, she's a manifesting carrier. And so they're, thankfully, they had two, there's been now two, I should say, different sessions and she was a part of. And that was very assuring for her to go, oh, that's why. And at the same time realizing, oh, this is a thing, as much as she, you know, knew about it. And we're so grateful because it's a new thing that they're delving into. And she's able, well, research is learning more. And then therefore, she's able to learn more, as is Marcy. So it was very interesting from that standpoint, having her there with me. And it was just a good time having some dad and daughter time for that trip because it was just the two of us. I'm so glad you could meet her.
It was such an honor to meet her. And on the flip side, Mark, I have met your daughter, one of your daughters as well.
That's right.
So to see the dynamic between Jamie and your daughter was, you know, phenomenal. But, you know, the same question, what got you to, you know, you both are naturals, but what got you to get in and want to speak and talk and open up about this journey?
Especially since LEMS has a much smaller community, there aren't as many voices and there's not as many patients. So you're more of a louder voice in a community that doesn't have a lot of voices.
That's a good question. You also, I think it was kind of a double question, Amy, you asked about how'd you go from survival to wanting to share. I would just say, and maybe Bill could relate, that I was in survival mode for a long time for both Sierra and Jamie. It seemed like we were drowning sometimes. Survival mode just seemed to last forever. But then around the time of Jamie's diagnosis, and then Sierra, my daughter, got married and started to recover, I feel like I could focus more and had more bandwidth. Bill used that word earlier. That's a great word. I had more bandwidth to make a difference. And because of my upbringing and my heart of service, and I say that in a humble way, when Catalyst came and said, we want you to be ambassadors, we were like, what? We could actually talk to other patients? Yes. You can meet other caregivers? Yes. Really? So like, it was kind of a no-brainer. I remember when my manager asks or your manager asks, I didn't even have to think about it. So I look at it, like Bill said, it's an honor to go somewhere or do a podcast like this and to share the story. And as you said, it is, LEMS is ultra rare. There's what, 3,000 or somewhat known cases. I'm sure there's more, but known cases in the U.S., I believe that's correct. I mean, you don't talk to these people on the street corner. So being able to show up somewhere and meet a LEMS patient, or in my case, another caregiver, is almost indescribable.
There are no family conferences for the LEMS community.
And Bill said, you're right. Bill said this earlier, people empathize, but they don't really know your journey because they're not in it. And they can empathize and they can show care. But until you've lived as a parent, a caregiver of someone with diseases like this, you don't know. And that's not to minimize those people, but they really don't know. So there's those feelings of feeling alone. Yeah, we could go somewhere and share. Hey, we're in. So like Bill, I mean, Jamie and I both look at it as an honor to be able to share whatever we can. We're not perfect and we're still learning. But if we could help somebody else, let's do it.
And we talked before we came on about how important it was for you and Mark, you know, Mark, you and Bill, to meet each other. And, you know, you're involved in completely separate rare diseases that are unrelated, but your experiences are very similar. And how important is that, meeting other fathers, other caregivers? And do you think there is enough support out there for fathers who are navigating this journey?
It is something, and it's amazing to be able to connect. Well, and it's also, and I think Mark would agree, when you do connect with another dad that gets it, it's not like the normal social awkwardness. It's like the normal social things are just scraped off the top, and you can connect at such a different level. That is amazing. And there's not as much as people would think out there. And so when you do find, and I've been very grateful for two different dads groups to be a part of, it's incredible. And they're both very small, and they're both in, very new, even. This is not something that's been thought of, at least on this side. I'm curious for Mark, it sounds like similar. It's just not available. And so I'm grateful.
Why do you think, knowing that there are so many more mother support groups, why do you think that there is less offerings for men and the dads or the spouses?
I would be guessing a bit, but it has been something. So I'll base something on something that you've probably all have seen. When we have gone to conferences, and there are wonderful families there, well, they're all wonderful families, so I don't want that to come across wrong, but there are many that are split homes, and it's the mom that shows up to those. And we know in general, you know, marriage is tough, but then in the rare disease or any disease, that's really a challenge for marriages. And a lot of the moms are there, and in the programs, I think, have lent themselves that way as a following just for sheer numbers. And I can see how sometimes, guys, as we are compartmentalizing, we are handling, we're pushing things down, that you might not always realize you need that. But yet, oh my goodness, you do. And it's so important. And I'm so grateful to have met Mark, and I look forward to continuing this. And I'm thank you. And it's just a special thing. And having those connections, there aren't words. But for those that get it, it really is something. And that would be something I would encourage anybody, any listener that's going through it, to find those communities to connect with. As small as they may be, they are very important.
Yeah, I feel like we're bringing this full circle where, Mark, you said at the get-go, you know, men tend to tap things down, just like Bill said, and push it down because they are in that male caregiving role. And yeah, Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
A couple things. I'll just say, when I met Bill in our pre-podcast conversations like this, where we could see each other, there was an immediate connection. And I, as you know, I have a mentoring organization for a long time, 42 years now. So I'm comfortable in my own skin and talking with other men. It's usually very young men in my circle. But the moment I met Bill, It's like he said, there's no masks because we get it. I didn't need him to do anything but just smile and listen. And then I smiled and listened to him, authentically listen, because as caregivers, that's the number one thing we do is listen, actively listen. What are you not telling me that you need? So there was an immediate connection. And we haven't texted or talked. I mean, we will, but there was an instant connection.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, and Carrie saw it.
Wonderful.
And the reason I'm saying it is, can I say the word suck? Men suck at that. If I'm not allowed,
yes, you can. Mark,
you're a man. You can say whatever you want.
Having been a mentor 42 years, again, not bragging, and we've journeyed with a couple hundred men all over the world that Jamie and I have helped. Men suck at relationships for a couple reasons. To answer your question, Amy, fear. Wow, if I'm in a friendship that when we can't talk about sports or the weather, or then what? I might have to be vulnerable. Bill might see my weaknesses and my imperfections. He got emotional there just a minute ago. I felt it. I felt my eyes water up. Men don't like that. In this country, it's unfortunate that men shouldn't show emotion because that's weak, and God forbid that we might hug each other for more than one microsecond. But I'm sure when I meet Bill, I'll give him a big bear hug because that's me, and that's one of my love.
We want to be there for that.
That's one of my love languages. Quality time and touch. I had a mentoring, this side journey mentoring meeting, what, two nights ago. That young man's been in my circle 10 years, and he waits for it. Give me that hug. I mean, in this country, we look at that as being, ooh, that's kind of girlish, or what's that hug really mean? Nothing. It's an act of love and kindness. And as much as women do, I'm going to say this out loud, men need those kinds of connections, not just sports and cars and NASCAR. And I'm for all of that, but listening and healthy touch in a healthy way, because those connections matter. Those connections give us the strength to take the next step. And thirdly, Amy, I think it's vulnerability. Especially in this country, again, we're taught that we can't be vulnerable. We have to be tough and have the answers. To me, that's a weakness. I feel like the strongest males that I know and my closest friends are the most vulnerable friends. And taking this back to caregiving, if you're not vulnerable in your caregiving journey, you're not going to make it. First, you have to be vulnerable with the person you care for, because it's a deep, deep connection. And then you can't do it by yourself. You have to have other people helping you. They got to know, where am I at? I'm having a really crappy time right now. I need your help. And not be ashamed of it. Lots of men can't do that. So I think it comes back to educating men, and I mean that in the kindest way. Telling them, hey, you're going to need some help, and it's okay to make connections. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to have tears. And I think you're a stronger man if you're willing to do that. Not weak, stronger.
Those are very powerful words, Mark. And I think a lot of people can learn from that. Thank you.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, I feel like we could go on for another hour talking about this. What do you wish someone had said to you at the start of this rare journey? And what message would you give other rare disease dads and husbands who are out there listening?
Ironically, it's just what was talked about. And I cannot say enough how important connecting with your community in the way of your disease. So those that we've connected with that have specific insights into the same, we've received amazing tips and support that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise, and hope to share with others. But then also the greater community, as what Mark and I have shared, as other caregivers, connecting with other caregivers. But the biggest thing, as Mark mentioned, we can't do it alone. We want to, but we can't. And that would be something to someone new to this journey. I know as guys, or even women too, so this is a very universal statement of, you feel like you want to champion it and do it on your own, as a show of love, which is admirable, but you need help. And it was hard to receive it. I'm so much more on the other side of so much easier to give it. I'll be the first to help. It's really hard to receive help, but it's so important.
Yeah, that's so true.
Mm. Yep, absolutely. Mark, can you expand on how you recognize that Jamie needs space and how did you give her that space?
Yeah, good question. So having been together this many years, we communicate nonverbally a lot. It always fascinates our kids. Like, you and mom are always talking, but you're not saying anything. The moment I walk in the house and I see your face or I see your eyes, I know where she's at. Men, that is a learned skill, by the way. You can learn to do that. It's not a feminine trait. It's not women's
intuition.
Tell
my husband that, Mark.
So, yeah, you read the room, for lack of a better way to put it. And then, this might sound simple, but ask her what she wants. Hey, babe, you look tired. Do you want me to make you some dinner or can I order out? What do you want? It's not me. I'm not the patient. I could just run in and solve it all and make all the decisions, but that robs her of her autonomy. And Bill, with having teenagers, they need that ability to be empowered. I'm not going to take that from her. So you could ask her, this is kind of funny, I've never told her what to do in 37 years. I ask her, what do you want? She's a human. She didn't need me when I showed up in Tulsa to change her life. What do you want? So the way I give her space is ask her, what do you need? And sometimes I'll even say, do you just need some space? Yes. No way. And it matters because when we were younger, and Bill could understand this, that would hurt me. I want to fix it for you. She didn't need me to fix it.
That's a good point.
She does not need me to fix her. There's no fix in here. It's let's manage it together and live as happy and as long as we can. So giving her the baton back, Amy, as much space as she needs. I think you know this, but there was a time in our life years ago where she needed a lot of space from me. It wasn't me or our marriage. I gave her that space.
Yeah, that must have been incredibly difficult.
And if I hadn't, yes, it was. If I hadn't given her that space that she asked for in a kind and tearful way, we wouldn't be together now. It wasn't about our marriage. It was about her needing to figure out her disease. My Lord, I just found out I have Lambert-Eaton's myasthenic syndrome. I don't even know what that is. I can't even spell the acronym. Am I going to die? What's going to happen? That takes space. And for Bill's lovely and wonderful family, space is important there, and autonomy and empowerment. So the way I do it is sometimes, you know, I just read her, or I'll just say, what do you need? She can tell me, right? And then give it to her. No strings attached, no hurt feelings. I just want to be alone tonight. Okay, cool. I'll go hang out with whoever. It's everything.
I think for men, that can be incredibly difficult because they have that innate fix it.
Yes.
You know, approach to things, which is
there's
a
no
good
fixing
thing too.
It
yeah.
is
yeah
it is but there's no fixing here
yeah
exactly. And Bill, I see you nodding a lot with what Mark is saying. What are your thoughts on the need for space, and is it something between Lucas, your wife, and your daughter that you've had to consider?
It is, and I just appreciate, I wanted to say, it was talked about earlier, but thank you for your vulnerability on the other side here, Mark. It is important, and to address things, and it makes space for others to do the same. And I thank you for this opportunity on here. And it's the thing that was coming up in mind was to love well, to love our families well. And in this case, whether it's my son or daughter or wife, to love them well is such an there's no ego in that. It's not about the fixing it side of things that I have to feel, even though that is a desire and can pop up some times. But you can do the right thing wrong. I don't know if that's the right way to say it. But we're, you know, sometimes in ourselves, we feel like we're being very admirable and wanting to, but that's not what they need or how they need it. And so to love well is to lay down our ego. I've really appreciated some of the points you brought up there, Mark, and I'll be taking from this conversation as well. And as we encourage others to do the same.
Yeah, again, well, very well said. Well said. And I appreciate that. Bill, Mark, thank you so so much for coming here today. This was an incredible conversation. I know it wasn't an easy conversation, but I know that there's going to be listeners out there that are going to take this to heart and be able to utilize from your experience.
You know, your stories remind us that the roles we take on when rare disease enters our lives isn't always easy or comfortable, but they are deeply important. You know, we really appreciate your honesty, your resilience, and your willingness to talk about the realities you both face.
Absolutely. And for those that are out there listening, and if today's conversation does resonate with you, please listen to other Catalyst Convos conversations. We have more topics coming out from the role social workers play, the healthcare within the Hispanic and Latino families. But again, thank you for joining us, and we hope to talk to you soon. And for those of you who are out there, if you have any topics that you'd like discussed that we haven't brought, you know, to the forefront, please reach out to advocacy@catalystpharma.com. We'd love to hear from you. But thank you again, Bill and Mark. This has been a fantastic conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
The podcast was produced in partnership with Amaze Media Lab.